If you're looking for a way to help birds or take your support to the next level, this May, I would love for you to join the Birds Canada Birdathon. It's easy to participate in and helps raise thousands of dollars for bird conservation. Learn more at birdscanada.org/birdathon. Now let's get to the episode.
From Birds Canada, this is The Warblers.
This is The Wake Up Call, a special podcast series from The Warblers by Birds Canada. I'm Andrea Grass.
And I am Andres Jimenez.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of The Wake Up Call by Birds Canada. So this is a special series where we're doing kind of deep dives into some of Canada's most threatened bird species. We're chatting with experts and researchers to figure out what lessons we can learn from some of these elusive birds and what we can learn about wildlife conservation across Canada in general. If you didn't check out the Piping Plover episode yet, please do. It was a lot of fun. And stay tuned for many more species-specific episodes to come. Today, we are chatting with Laura Tranquilla, the Atlantic Director for Birds Canada. She's based in Sackville, New Brunswick. Laura's interest in birds began with studying songbirds in the black fly-infested forests of her home province. But her heart was stolen by seabirds after she stepped into a stormy, remote seabird colony. Since then, she's dedicated around 20 years to bird ecology, physiology, tracking, and conservation on the east and west coasts of Canada. And I am so excited for the bird we're going to chat with her about.
Yes, I've been wanting to make this episode since we started the podcast. And here are some facts about this bird before we go to Laura. These are robin-sized seabirds that fly over the water with erratic, bounding wing beats. The total population is probably in the millions. But recently, we discovered it had reduced by 40% without us knowing exactly why. The biggest nesting population is right here in Canada. And they nest in lonely islands and are very, very long-lived, being older than you and me, probably. And without further ado, we welcome to the Warblers Podcast, Laura. How are you, Laura?
Hi, I'm well. Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
How do you feel about Leach's storm petrels?
Well, I have to say, I really love them. Like, I love my husband and my kids, and then next on the list is the Leach's storm petrel.
I feel like that's how I feel about piping plovers. But then when I was learning about this species preparing for this episode, I'm like, okay, plovers, watch out. We've got a contender coming for you because these birds are so cool.
Laura, why do you love Leach's storm petrel this much?
You know how some people are really interested in elves and fairies and like magical things? I feel that way about Leach's storm petrel.
They do feel magical.
They're very captivating because they're sort of mysterious and not often seen. But then when you start to learn about them, you just understand how really interesting and cool they are.
What's interesting and cool about them?
They're just little, small, sooty gray seabirds. But in a bigger context, they're part of a family of seabirds that include albatrosses, shearwaters, fulmars, and petrels. And these are known as the tube noses. All birds in this family share some really cool traits. So, cool trait number one, they have this short tube-like structure. It's like a little straw layered on the top of their bill that gives them an excellent sense of smell. And that helps them in finding food or navigating in the ocean, and perhaps also in recognizing the smells of familiar places like their colonies or their mates even. Cool thing number two, they are among the very few truly pelagic seabirds, which means they spend almost all their lives flying around over the open ocean, very far out at sea. Cool thing number three is that all the birds in this tube nose group are very long-lived. The oldest known Leach's storm petrel is 38 years old, and the oldest known albatross, which is another member of this family, is 70 years old. And it's just very cool and also very humbling to think that the bird you're studying, perhaps even holding in your hand, might be older than you are.
Have you developed a relationship with any of them? Do you kind of like, as you're studying them, think, yeah, I saw you last year. It's great to see that you're doing well.
Yes, that does happen. a lot of what we know about leeches storm petrel has come from long-term monitoring studies at colonies. The longest study of this kind is on Kent Island in the Bay of Fundy in New Brunswick. And it's actually been studied since, I think, 1952, this colony. And so there was one, kind of one of the more famous petrel researchers. His name was Chuck Huntington, and he worked out of Bowdoin College. And he knew, he studied birds on this island for 50 years, and some of them he knew, and he would see them like every year for 50 years as he was going back to these colonies. So you do develop a relationship, and sometimes also you have a new student who's coming to the island to work on a petrel, and the bird will actually, you know, be older than they are. And it's just, it gives them a really interesting perspective.
Laura, you've said that these birds are mysterious. And I'm assuming that part of that mystery is that they spend their life in the ocean. But what's the rest of the mystery? How often would someone, could someone encounter a leech's storm petrel?
I think the mystery is because they're nocturnal. If you're at a petrel colony, despite the fact that it might be full of petrels, you'll never see one in the daytime. So you could be walking around a colony and have all these petrel burrows underfoot, and you will, you won't even know that they're there. So that's part of it. The colonies come alive at night under cover of darkness. The other place that they're seen is really far out at sea, where people rarely go. So the people that are most likely to encounter this bird are fishermen who are on the high seas. So they're mysterious because they don't kind of share their lives with us in the way that a songbird or something coming to your feeder might, you know, be more observable to people who are taking an interest in their surroundings and in the wildlife around them, because it's just rare to encounter them.
What you're telling me is that this species spends most of its life flying on top of the ocean, that when it comes to an island to nest, it goes into a cave, and that when it's active at night. You're basically describing a ghost here, and it makes me wonder, yeah, how is it that you found out that petrels exist? What is it? How is it that you came across the first petrel?
The first time I encountered a petrel was when I went to a seabird island. But I went to the island to actually band songbirds. There was a migration monitoring station there. And my first night on the island, I was sleeping in a little cabin in the woods. And when it got dark, around 11 p.m., I started hearing all these weird noises, like otherworldly, like yelping, cackling, purring noises, these like elfish sounds coming from the woods all around me. And so what was happening was that all the leech's storm petrels were returning to the breeding colony, which they do only at night. And they started calling to each other. So it was just a really amazing revelation to me that there could be this huge colony of seabirds, but it was effectively invisible until the nighttime when you suddenly start hearing them all and you get that blast of petrel sound.
Let's listen to some of the petrels right now. How would any of our listeners get to see a petrel? What would they have to do?
Petrels are not easy to find. If you would go on a pelagic boat tour, like a whale watching tour, you might see them out at sea foraging on the surface of the water, where they sort of look like gray butterflies dangling their feet in the water. So unless you're on a whale watch tour, you would only see them if you are at a colony. And it's, you know, it's sort of tricky because you don't recommend people go to colonies in droves because these are sensitive places. You don't want people kind of tromping around on the top of a colony full of burrows. Something that does happen sometimes is that petrels will come ashore accidentally. Either are they blown in by bad weather or they're actually attracted by lights in coastal communities. And so sometimes you can see them stranded in coastal areas where there might be a petrel colony nearby. This happens sometimes in Newfoundland on the Avalon Peninsula or in southwest Nova Scotia. So you might see them accidentally.
So if we see one accidentally, it's potentially a sign that that bird's off course and, you know, make sure to give them space.
Yes. There's actually a really interesting program in Newfoundland that's run by CPAWS. That's a Canadian Parks and Wilderness Society. They have a branch in Newfoundland. And there's a big issue in a community called Whitless Bay that is just adjacent to one of the largest seabird petrel colonies in Newfoundland. And they have a lot of coastal lighting in that community. And at certain times of year, a bunch of petrels and also Atlantic puffins get attracted to the shore, and they get stranded in coastal communities. So they have this whole program with CPAWS and connected to Environment and Climate Change Canada, where people in the community actually collect the birds at night because they'll just be sitting on the road or sitting on your lawn, and they can be damaged or injured or by predators when that happens. So they put them in a safe place, hold them till morning, and then release them to the ocean the next day. And so that's one way that communities can actually help storm petrels that are stranded.
Wow.
Big hug to our friends at CPAWS Nova Scotia. Thanks for the work you do.
Newfoundland. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds like a really cool program. Great way to get a community involved too in some conservation. I've heard that a nickname for these birds is Mother Carey's chicks. Could you enlighten us on that?
This is a superstitious reference that dates back to seafaring traditions, like back to the 1700s and perhaps earlier. So Mother Carey is a mythological figure from sailor folklore. She's supposed to be this sea hag that personifies the cruel and threatening sea. And there's another story that says she's the wife of Davy Jones. Some people might be familiar with that fable of Davy Jones, who's a devilish figure who calls shipwrecked sailors to their death at the bottom of the sea into Davy Jones's locker. So in this sailor folklore, when Mother Carey swoops over the sea, she's bringing in stormy weather and dangerous seas. And so storm petrels were considered by sailors to be forerunners of bad storms. And they were also considered by sailors to represent the souls of drowned sailors, potentially those that drowned after storms that Mother Carey had riled up. So it's probably because of the association of storm petrels with these deep oceanic waters, which is where they forage for food. And the fact that fishermen usually see petrels far out at sea during this rough and stormy weather. And so storm petrels became known as stormy petrels or Mother Carey's chicks.
It's also eerie, like right from the start you were talking about fairies and like kind of the mythological pull that these birds have, and it sounds like that's dated back for a long time. That's not just your experience, but maybe a lot of people who encounter them kind of feel the same way.
Imagine if the reason we think there are mysterious elves and fairies in the forest is because ancient peoples used to go into the woods and hear these weird noises, and it's actually storm petrels. That could be.
Yes, the original fairy.
I'm just making that up.
No, I love that idea. So tell us how storm petrels are faring in Atlantic Canada.
Not great. And despite being one of the most numerous seabird populations in the Atlantic, they're declining throughout the whole Atlantic on our side in eastern Canada, and also in the eastern Atlantic, which would be like Scotland, Iceland, and those areas. So the storm petrel was listed in 2016 on the IUCN Red List as vulnerable. And then they were assessed as threatened under COSIWIC, which is the Committee on the Status of Endangered Wildlife in Canada. And this listing was because of a dramatic population decline at several Atlantic colonies, including the world's largest colony on Baccalieu Island in Newfoundland, where there's been an estimated 42% decline over the last 30 years.
42%. That's pretty huge. How do we know there's been that big of a decline?
It's from colony census information. 30 years ago, colony was censused, so that's somebody went to the island, and usually you can't count every single petrel burrow on an island because there's just too many. So what happens is you take a sample of like quadrets of an island, and you count all the burrows and all the birds in that, and then you extrapolate that to the full extent of the island, so you get a number. So the first count would be about 3.4 million pairs of birds on an island. And then they do that census in the same way at intervals a certain number of years later and do the same count. And when you get a different number, that means what you're counting on a particular island is representative of what's happening with that whole island. That type of census has occurred in a number of colonies, and it's showing the same kind of declining pattern. So it's not information from a single place, but information from multiple places that's showing us the same kind of pattern.
We'll be right back.
How do you like your coffee, Andre? Cream? Sure?
I like mine bird-friendly, certified.
Then I have just the brew for you. Birds and Beans coffee roasters only use beans from farmers who keep the native forest habitat intact, growing coffee in the shade of a variety of native trees.
That's good for migratory birds.
Good for everyone. This coffee is even certified by the Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center. It protects biodiversity, supports sustainable farming, and it's fur trade, and organic too.
Ah, not to mention delicious.
Deliciously bird-friendly. If any of our listeners also like their coffee bird-friendly certified, here's how to get it. Order online at birdsandbeans.ca/warblers. Make sure to use the /warblers because that means Birds and Beans will also donate 10% of the purchase price to support this podcast. You can also use the link on your podcast player.
Sounds great. Andreas, how about another cup?
Let's do it.
What are the biggest threats that are affecting their population?
For petrels and for many seabirds, there's really no clear, like, smoking gun to explain the dramatic decline. Reasons are probably multiple, perhaps cumulative, sort of like the metaphor of a death by a thousand cuts, which, I'm sorry, that's not a very nice saying, but it sort of applies here. So for petrels, top threats probably include predation and disturbance at colony. So petrels, along with other ground nesting seabirds, are vulnerable to disturbance at their breeding colonies. So it could be introduced predators or natural predators like cats, rats, mink, foxes, marten, mostly mammals that eat, it's easy to dig up a burrow and eat what's in there. Also avian predators like gulls, which sometimes also live on petrel colonies, owls, crows, and ravens. They're really smart and they know how to dig up burrows too. So those types of predators can eat chicks and adults. And there's also could be disturbance or destruction of breeding habitat itself, like from erosion, changes in habitat, vegetation structure, or even recreational disturbance at colonies. So that colony-based disturbance is one potential threat. We also think that environmental contaminants could be playing a role. This would be things like mercury, organochlorines, plastics. These things accumulate in petrel body tissues and have potential to cause illness or behavioral dysfunctions or problems with growth and development of chicks. Another one is fatal light attraction. So petrels are very vulnerable to light pollution. And that's because they're nocturnal and they navigate at night using light from the moon and the stars. And they also feed at night on these glow-in-the-dark fish called myctophids. And so they're really used to using light as natural cues in their environment. But then when they get attracted to the glow of artificial lights, they can become disoriented or stranded and collide with structures or vehicles and vessels. And when they're stranded, they can also become injured. We don't understand fully how much of an impact that is having. A couple of other things, climate-driven changes in habitat and food supply. So shifts in where and when their food is available in the ocean, what kind of food it is, what the quality of that food is, could have an impact on survival of petrels. There's two other things. Where are petrels going in their whole life cycle? Like where are their wintering grounds? We don't know a lot about that and to what extent they might be encountering threats on their wintering grounds. And also, how many young birds, like pre-breeders, survive from fledging their colony to going back to the breeding colony, which doesn't happen for 5 to 7 years. So there's these young birds out in the ocean for up to 7 years hanging out before they even go back to a breeding colony. We have no idea what's happening with those birds during that period of life. So that's a lot of stuff. Ongoing research is attempting to answer these questions, but it's really difficult to advocate or campaign for a specific conservation action when there might be a lot of things going on that contribute to their decline.
Laura, it sounds like there's a lot of threats that this species is dealing with. It can kind of almost be overwhelming. How do you think we should address all that?
It is overwhelming, especially for researchers who have been studying this bird for a long time and might want to know more or do more. I think even though we know there are a lot of different issues and threats for this bird, every little thing we can do to either understand the situation or make some small change to improve conservation, all those things add up. So this is how we counter death by a thousand cuts, is we start doing small conservation action, sort of like conservation with a thousand band-aids. And hopefully that will turn the situation around to a more positive place.
I love the idea of hope by a thousand actions. Laura, you're telling me that the cuts to this species involve predators, disturbance to the islands, climate change, light pollution, plastic pollution, and then not really knowing where they are at during when they're wintering. And I am wondering, does the human perception or lack of perception of these birds influence these threats as well? Us considering them mysterious or even threatening for fishermen when they see them at sea, does that influence this conservation efforts?
There are some things that I think the perception of petrels could be improved to help certain situations. So for example, if they're considered to be bad luck, you can do a bit of work around changing the perception of petrels so that people are more likely to help them, you know, if they would see a stranded petrel. That's something that we could address. Perhaps more awareness of how affected the marine environment is and how we can take ownership of that could help petrels as well. But it's hard to pinpoint specific things because there are so many widespread kind of issues here.
When it's so complicated with so many different causes, how are we doing or how are we attempting to conserve this species when there are so many factors of this system?
I think right now, conservation efforts are still really focused on gathering information. There's a lot of ongoing research to try and identify what possible threat would have a, you know, a greater impact, and trying to really kind of tease out some of the issues for different populations of petrels.
It sounds like we've got a lot to learn, but on the other hand, we already know that like a lot of these threats are impacting other birds as well. Like we talked about albatrosses with Sarah Gutowski in our seabird episode, and a lot of the same threats you're mentioning now are exactly what's affecting albatrosses too. So, you know, maybe is it time to just start acting, you know, and hope that what we do will affect not only leeches, storm petrels, but a whole swath of other seabirds?
I think so. Anything we do to help the marine environment is going to help all the animals that interact with the marine environment and ourselves as well. I mean, the oceans cover most of this earth. And so, again, it's hard for people to get out into the ocean. It's hard for people to engage with that marine environment unless they work and live at sea. I think there is something to be said for just doing our best to improve the conservation status of our marine environment.
What is the main lesson this species is teaching us about how we do conservation and how we relate to wildlife?
Main lesson. I think
that's a big sigh.
It is. So for me, it's how do we balance patience in understanding a complex system with the potential urgency of a conservation need.
Can you decompose that a bit more for me? That's a big argument.
I know. I don't have an answer for it. But so birds can give us insight into what's happening at a very large ecosystem scale. But it's very difficult and complicated to figure out what they're telling us. So leeches, storm petrel, are super long-lived. They raise only a single chick once a year. And this means like populations take a really long time to respond to change or adapt to threats and pressures. And these petrels are also ranging very widely at sea and are likely affected by a whole suite of threats, all tied to the marine ecosystem. So while they're still very numerous, and we know there's been this dramatic population decline, we can't figure out why. So what do you do when you can see that there's a problem, like a slow train wreck about to happen, but actions for conservation are unclear? So I think leeches, storm petrel teaches us to watch, to listen, to try our best to predict what's happening, and keep looking for answers and then appreciate wildlife in the meantime.
Andrea, what lesson have you got from this conversation with Laura?
Oh, it's what lesson have I got? Oh, I feel like a lot of our threatened species are all facing the same problems in just the fact that there's so many threats. And I feel like we're not listening to them, right? Andres, what are some of the lessons you've learned from Leech's Storm Petrel today?
On my end, I feel that I've learned from Laura and from Leech's Storm Petrels that a mysterious bird is hard to protect and to conserve, not only because you need people's support to do it, but you also need to understand it. I've also learned that understanding a species to the maximum before taking actions to protect it might not be the best approach, but might be the only approach at the same time. And I think that's what it feels that we're doing with Leech's Storm Petrel. And that can feel incredibly frustrating for the people like Laura working with Leech's Storm Petrel. Have you ever felt like that, Laura?
It is frustrating because there's always more to know. And there's lots of research right now going on, particularly around light pollution and tracking of birds into the wide open ocean. But at the same time, you know, okay, we just have to get the plastic out of the ocean. We have to encourage local governments to support better environmental policies for marine conservation and management. It'd be great if we...
Like pollution.
Yeah, great if we could reduce light pollution in coastal communities and in offshore environments. We don't have to know a whole lot more to know that just in general, that would be better for the marine environment.
I think that's the most powerful lesson from this species. It doesn't matter how mysterious it is. We know enough as to be able to take the right decisions in order for petrels to thrive. And any additional knowledge we might get, it's an added value.
It is. And maybe if we keep studying them and we keep trying some actions, we will be able to notice a change in their population status in the future.
Which is why it's incredibly important to continue to study them, right? It's a very numerous bird. And you said earlier that we picked up on this collapse of their population by 40%. And if we wouldn't been studying them, even though they're numerous, we wouldn't have picked up on this.
That's right.
What actions would you recommend for listeners who might be interested in helping the species?
Well, I think first, you know, a great place to start is to spread the word. You know, the more people appreciate and value seabirds and our oceans, the more likely it is that we will collectively want to take care of it. I think we can encourage our governments to support better environmental policies. If you happen to live in a coastal community, especially near offshore islands, which are or could be petrel colonies, you can help the species by reducing light pollution. Turn off your lights, shield your lights from the sky, work with communities and businesses to reduce nighttime lighting at a larger scale, especially during the summer breeding season. So this has actually been effective in some places. If you live in coastal communities, maybe keep your eyes open for any birds that might be coming on shore and getting stranded. And then for sure, reduce your plastic consumption. I mean, you know, do what you can to change your shopping habits, avoid products with microbeads, promote the use of recycled plastic, and consider supporting initiatives that reduce and eliminate ocean plastic pollution.
We'll be right back.
The Warblers is a podcast of Birds Canada. Our goal is to bring you the information you need to discover, enjoy, and protect birds. If you like what you hear, please subscribe, leave a review, and share this podcast with everyone you know. Birds Canada relies on the support of donors like you. To learn more or to make a donation, visit birdscanada.org. And if you give, please note the podcast in the comment box.
You've given us so many visuals this episode, and I keep on imagining myself having in my hand a Leech's Storm Petrel, like when you study them and you need to find them in their caves, and having it in my hand and thinking that it might be 40 years old and it might be older than me, and yet it can be so vulnerable, at the same time so resistant and so well adapted to the environment it lives. And it's so humbling to think that in my hands I got so much power to help that bird thrive. And I would like to tell to our listeners, go listen to our episode on seabirds. Listen to this episode. Share it with everyone you know so we can learn more about seabirds. If you live in a coastal area, if you live anywhere, to be honest, wherever you live, be sure to reduce the light pollution at night, as Laura recommended, and then adjust your consuming behaviors. Reducing the plastic in your life is going to be good for you, but it's going to be good for thousands of species.
And be sure to check out the links and the various articles we've included in this episode description to continue learning about the species and more. Laura, where could people go to follow you or learn more about you?
I am on the Birds Canada website under the staff pages, and I can also be emailed at my work address at ltranquilla@birdscanada.org.
Thank you so much for sharing your love of leeches, storm petrels with us today. I hope that thousands of people fall in love with them through this episode.
I hope so too. Just imagine being in the dark, listening to elves, and the magic of the leeches, storm petrel.
The Warblers is produced by Andres Jimenez, Jody Allaire, Andrea Greff, Ruth Friendship Keller, and Kate Lowlish. This episode was edited by Greg McLaughlin and engineered by Katie Zhang, with the music by Jose Mora and art by Alex Nicol. Until next time, keep birding.